Okay. Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Voice of America and to our symposium on Indochina. To start us off this morning, Mr. Joseph Bruns, who's the acting director of VOA, has a few words to set us on the path here. Joe.
Good morning. Most Americans had never heard of the countries of Indochina until France struggled to maintain its pre-World War II position there in the 1950s. The French departure there did not bring peace to Indochina, and Indochina remained in the news. Its strategic importance grew as Vietnam and Laos fought a stubborn communist insurgency. In 1965, the U.S. considered the region important enough to actively engage itself by sending ground troops to Vietnam. As the military and political struggle escalated in Indochina, debate over U.S. policy escalated at home. Events in Indochina helped shape the politics of a generation, my generation. It precipitated the fall of a sitting president and put new stress on such problems in U.S. society as drug abuse, civil rights, and racial relations. The war's outcome has been a major factor in American political and military strategy ever since. The recurrent theme has been no more Vietnams. Even in the recent presidential election, service in Vietnam became a major issue. Although American combat forces were withdrawn from Vietnam in 1973, 20 years ago, last month, the Vietnam War still lives more vigorously in the American consciousness than the recent war we won, Desert Storm. Now we are trying to put all this into a perspective. This symposium is an effort to look ahead. The view is not yet clear. Policies are still being formulated. There is a sense of foreboding about the Cambodian elections scheduled in May. Will these elections bring about true democratic governments and a new hope for Cambodia? And what will happen when the U.S. normalizes relations with Vietnam, as is sure to happen soon? What do these two respective sides expect? And what are they actually going to get? These are just a few of the questions that we look forward to hearing about from our distinguished panel and speakers today. I look forward to an exciting, lively, and informative discussion here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. So I think you probably have gotten program. So day is divided into two sessions. The first this morning will be more about the present of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. This afternoon, starting at 2 p.m., we'll be talking more about the next decade, the future of those three countries, and the relationship with the United States. Douglas Pike, who is the director of the Indochina Studies Project at the University of California in Berkeley, is chairman of the presentations, the moderator, and so he's seated in the middle. I would just briefly introduce the other panelists before we start. Starting from the right here is Dr. Fred Brown, who's the director of Southeast Asian Studies at the NITSI School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University's Foreign Policy Institute, retired State Department FSO who served in Thailand and in Vietnam. Next is Stephen Johnson, who is now with the State Department, analyst for Indochina at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. He's also served in Saigon and other countries or other cities in Vietnam. Then there's Doug Pike, and then Dr. Willard Sharp, who's an economist with extensive experience in Asia, also retired FSO, chief of the Joint USAID Embassy Economic Office in Saigon when he served there, also was with the Chase Manhattan Bank as the principal economic analyst for Asia. And then Ms. Kataria who's a research specialist on Southeast Asia with a doctorate from the University of California, And she was a lecturer at San Francisco University last year, a consultant for the RAND Corporation, and is now teaching at Berkeley. And then finally, if you're facing it on the far left, then Nguyen Man Hung, who is the director of the Indochina Institute and associate professor of government and politics at George Mason University, former professor of international politics at the University of Saigon, and former deputy minister of national planning of the Republic of Vietnam. Just one other thing I would note, that we have put together a list of selected publications by our panelists, and this would be available in the back of the room if anybody wants to have a copy of that. So now I'll turn the program over to Doug Pike, and he begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert, for that very effusive introduction of the lineup here. You're all probably sitting there wondering if these guys are also damn good. How come we lost the Vietnam War? My task here, as I see it, is a scene setter. And to that end, what I would like to do is first let me start my stopwatch. This is not an ordinary stopwatch. It contains a small thermonuclear device. If I do not finish on time, it zaps me. I'm thinking of marketing this at academic conferences around the world. I should make a fortune out of it. So what I would like to do is to divide my remarks as strictly as scene setters. I would not like to dazzle you with brilliance. I would like to simply tick off in a somewhat boring fashion the basic points of history in the post-Vietnam era that I think most of you know, most of you here, although I would say most of the people in the country do not know it, since, as Mr. Bruns noted, it vanished from the subject vanished from the front pages at the end of the Vietnam War. And Vietnam then went to, as Mary McGrory has put it, back among the hemorrhoid ads. But so there are about five of these points that I think are simply to remind the group here. What happened after 1975? First, with respect to Indochina, the three Indochinese states and the ASEAN states, there was this double helix of luck. You know, a double helix is one spiral up and another spiral down. In 1975, the conventional wisdom was that the Leninist states had won, they were on the glory road, and the future was theirs. The rest of Southeast Asia, the ASEAN states, were at the time, as they say, around the track, they were running scared. Instead, we saw this strange phenomenon of the winners becoming the losers, and the losers, those who backed the losers, particularly becoming the winners. I think the Politburo in Hanoi has been spending 12 years trying to figure out exactly why this happened, and it is a genuine historical phenomenon, something there will probably be a lot of dissertations written on eventually. That was the first development, that the way history should have gone under common sense following the end of the war in this way did not simply go the way it common sense said it would. And second was the outbreak of the Cold War between the Chinese and the Vietnamese. This once intimate lip and teeth arrangement, although we know now it was never all that close, but it began going downhill, culminated with a actual hot war, a short hot war in 1979 when China invaded Vietnam. Since then, it has deteriorated into a Cold War that promises to improve perennially, but has not yet. My thesis here is that what I'm saying about this historical context is that this was an era that began with the end of the Vietnam War and an era that ended with the revolution of 1989. And I would argue that what we're seeing in Indochina and Southeast Asia from now on is really a new era. It's the post-war era of Southeast Asia. New problems, new rules, new challenges, almost everything is new. So what I'm talking about really now is the period from the end of the war to about the middle of 1989. Third development, the internecine war among the Indochinese communists. The Red Brotherhood broke up, Southern Vietnamese communists versus Northern Vietnamese communists split. They didn't really split, the North just emasculated them. And then, of course, the outbreak of, or the breakup of the Red Brotherhood between the Cambodian and Vietnamese communists. Holocaust in Kampuchea, Cambodia, killing fields. Social trauma in Vietnam, this is the fourth development. The re-education camps, the new economic zones, the breaking of the machine. These were programs were not really economic. They were designed to restructure the social order. They are not economic, they're not educational in any real sense of the word. And then finally, as part of this Holocaust, the whole boat people phenomenon, which a million Indochinese left their country when during the war, and the trauma there, hardly anybody left. Five, the rise of influence of regionalism. I think regionalism is a historical force worldwide, and it is very much one in Southeast Asia. The predecessors to ASEAN, CETO, and the Mekong scheme and so on really never amounted to anything. This is the first regional grouping that has really had bite and had significance. There was the Soviet, six was the Soviet regional military buildup, particularly naval, that is now in decline. And with it came fear in the region of continued superpower competition and the fear of possible nuclear war. That is now definitely in decline, if not moribund. So the seventh then was the, out of this really is the changed. And probably the most, it's the most abstract, but the most important development is the changed definition of regional national security. What is the national interest of each of the countries involved? In the past, it, and through early in this era, it was strictly strategic. Question of a need for outside alliance and the perennial problem for internal security. Each of these countries had guerrilla wars, and that was largely dominated the security thinking of the governments. That now, too, appears to be in decline. Whether it's permanent or not is another matter. Possible exception to that probably is the Philippines. All of this was more or less directly the result of the way the Vietnam War ended. And with the end of, and with the end of the war, there began this new era, which has now ended, as I say, with the advent of the revolution of 1989. We don't have, we're in a new era now, we don't really have a name for it yet. And to date it has largely been a European phenomenon. It started there and grew there probably because the soil was more fertile. What are its prospects, or what are the, how this is going to play out in Asia, particularly Leninist Asia, China, North Korea, and Vietnam, is a very moot question. In fact, it is by far the single most important question to ask at the moment. Which of the forces that triggered this revolution of 1989 are at work in these Leninist countries, and what can we expect from them? In what ways will they influence the thinking, actions, general behavior, or will they, or in what way will they be turned or shaped or shunted off by Confucian culture? If we knew that for sure, we'd know really all we need to know about the future development of Asia. Now, to the second part of this, which is the current scene in Indochina. I, again, do not mean and don't intend to upstage my colleagues here by saying very much on any of this. I just want, again, try to set the framework for what we can what will follow for the rest of the day. First, on economics, I think economics is now in command, as an early Vietnamese Communist Party slogan had it. There has been considerable improvement in the past two, three years in Vietnam and Laos, less so Cambodia because of the war conditions. For 10 years, the Asian ASEAN states improved economically at a rapid rate, and the Indochinese states stagnated. Only recently, as I say, has this begun to change in a significant way. Many problems are left. I will tick off in about one sentence each what I see are the chief impediments to economic and political development. This applies particularly, I would say, to Vietnam, also to Laos in a somewhat different way, and eventually perhaps to Cambodia. First is a need for leadership that understands the principles of economic development and is willing to make sacrifice in other sectors, such as allocation of resources away from the armed forces, in the name of the economy. Second impediment is a weak infrastructure. Transportation, communication, the standard aspects parts of an infrastructure. Also, in my view, particularly based on my trips to Vietnam, where this came home much more strongly, weakness in educational infrastructure. The teaching of science, technology, it simply isn't there. In our university, they will keep telling you, we are still turning out students for the bicycle age. All over Southeast Asia, they're turning them out to the computer age. And it's the science, research, R&D work. It's a population that is computer literate that is, in my opinion, perhaps the greatest impediment to economic development. Third weakness, the social consensus, the lack of it. Social consensus is a term that sociologists use primarily. It applies to all societies, and it asks really three questions. What kind of a people are we? That's the first question. What do we stand for? A second question, where do we want to go in a kind of general philosophic way? That is, what is our social vision? And third question is, how do we want to get there? Well, how you get there is really another word for politics, and there's always going to be a great disputation on that. All countries have this, we have this problem in this country, asking these three questions. But in Indochina, particularly in Vietnam, I would say, and in some ways in Cambodia, perhaps even worse, there is not this social consensus. There simply isn't the agreement as to what this country stands for, where it ought to go, and how it ought to get there. It's not to say you can't make some development, but it's simply to say that it is an overriding impediment. And the fourth impediment is investment capital, spelt broadly, which includes technology transfer and so on. And then the fifth is huge amounts of money, money that makes money, capital investment. Where is it going to come from? And then fifth, the foreign relations is an impediment to any kind of improvement generally. Oh, you don't actually have to have good relations with your neighbors, but it certainly helps. Vietnam, as you know, has been surrounded by enemies for a very long time. It has, for a long time, had only two friends in the world, Vietnam, or the Soviet Union, and Cuba, and then it was down to one. They're working quite hard to end this. I think their chief foreign policy problems are not necessarily in this order. One is the Cambodian peace process. They do have a vested interest in it. Vietnam does have a genuine, legitimate national security interest in what happens in Cambodia and Laos, and they mean to serve that if they can. China, of course, is the overriding foreign policy. It is only the, in a sense, it's the only real problem that they have. China's too big, it's too near for any kind of a permanent condition of hostility. I think both the Chinese and the Vietnamese recognize this, but it takes two to tango. Vietnamese, I would say, are making a concentrated effort to try to improve relations. The Chinese are still being quite punitive about this. They feel the Vietnamese were very ungrateful for the assistance they got, and I had a tour last year of China talking about Vietnam, and this is what I got everywhere from the Chinese, that they are, the Vietnamese are a bunch of ungrateful wretches, and we took lots of casualties, and therefore we must punish them for this. And I say, well, don't you think you punished them enough? And one general said, well, not quite. but I think that's going to solve itself early. There's then the chief economic foreign problem of the Vietnamese is to gain this capital development money, which is primarily going to mean international funding agency assistance. And then finally, their chief objective final objective of the Vietnamese foreign policy is to establish a better working relationship or a true full relationship with the United States. I think on only one thought on that at the moment, and that is that I don't think it's just a question of the embargo coming down or of diplomatic recognition, which is a technical facilitative thing in which we exchange embassies. I think the real problem for the Vietnamese is to try to think out exactly what kind of a relationship they want with the United States in the future. What kind of a role do they see for this? And this goes back to China, because it's my firm belief that the Chinese do not want intimate relations between Vietnam and the ASEAN states. They don't want them to join ASEAN. And I think if the truth be known, the Chinese would prefer that our present relationship or non-U.S. non-relationship would continue. But the answer to that really, in that respect, lies in Beijing rather than in Hanoi. But nevertheless, once the embargo comes down and diplomatic relations are formed, this will, from my thinking, for the Vietnamese, be the start of their problems on how to deal with the U.S. It will not be the end. Will be the beginning. Okay, well, that's once over lightly. So we can now be turned to our panelists. First is Mr. Hung, Dr. Nguyen Man Hung. Right, you are?
Mr. Short.
Sorry. I can't tell the players without a scorecard. I'm sorry, Bill.
I thought you were going to wipe me out.
Well, even if you are an economist, you're a good friend of mine. All right, Bill Sharp.
Well, I've been asked to talk about the economy of Vietnam. It's a very complex and fast-moving subject, and I thought I'd attack it by picking out four topics representing four key sectors of the economy and give each one of those a quick kind of snapshot look. And see if I can't sum up from that what's been happening. Since I only have about 15 minutes to do this before I get zapped by your little stopwatch there, I'm going to plunge right into this. My four topics then are rice, oil, the state-owned companies, and foreign investment. So for rice, still the dominant economic activity in Vietnam in terms of the number of people involved, I think that almost three out of four Vietnamese are still involved in rice culture in one sense or another, growing it, milling it, trading it, moving it around. But after the war in the 1970s, and in fact until the late 1980s, Vietnam was actually a net importer of rice, and was bringing in from 500,000 tons to as much as 800,000 tons a year, Soviet financed, to take care of consumption in the country. The reason for this has been very clear, that the collectivized farming system, which had existed in the the North since the 1950s, and which was imposed in the South after 1975, simply wasn't working very well. So the economic reform programs, which began in a very tentative way, and some to an extent stumbling way in the early 1980s, but got going more effectively after 1986, concentrated first on this problem. And the collective system was, in many respects, then dismantled. And the farming system of Vietnam was returned basically to a farm, to a family-based system with appropriate incentives. Now, the results of that were quickly and dramatically successful. A production of paddy rice, which had been only 15 million tons in 1986, rose to last year's figure of over 21 million tons, an increase of more than a third. And this permitted Vietnam to go to shift from being a rice importer to being a major rice exporter. And last year's Vietnam exported 1.9 million tons of milled rice, which made Vietnam the third largest exporter after Thailand and the U.S. So this was a very major success for the economic reform program, a success not only economic, but I think psychologically and in prestige terms. And I believe it ensures that over the next few years, the reform program will continue. Nevertheless, I have a couple of reservations about this success. Reservation number one is that it's very clear that not all Vietnamese are eating very well. And we're getting continuing reports from within the Vietnamese government, reports from UN agencies, and most recently a World Bank report on population health and nutrition in Vietnam. The World Bank said last year that approximately half of all Vietnamese children are malnourished. This is a quite striking fact. The second reservation I have has to do with the growth of population. In the early 1960s, when some of us first became involved in Vietnam, the population, North and South combined, was something on the order of 35 million. Today it is 71 million, so it has doubled in approximately 30 years. And it is still increasing at a rate in excess of 2% per year, so that it will cross the 100 million mark probably quite early in the next century. So the question really is whether rice production can keep up with that in a country where there isn't very much arable land left to cultivate, and in which the benefits of the Green Revolution have already been exploited to a considerable extent. Next subject is oil. Until 1989, Vietnam didn't produce any oil and imported all of its oil products. They were all Soviet financed, I believe. In the mid-1980s, imports of oil products were running at about 2.5 million tons a year. Production of crude oil then began, I think, in late 1988, and since then, Vietnam has been exporting crude every year with increases each year. Last year, 1992, they exported 5.4 million tons of oil. That's, if you turn that into barrels per day, it's something like 115,000 barrels per day. Now this, I should say that Vietnam still doesn't have an oil refinery, so they are importing their oil products, exporting crude, but the exports of crude are more than paying for the imports of products, so we can say definitely Vietnam is now a net exporter of oil. Now this second success, I think, cannot, to tell the truth, be attributed to the economic reform program. All of the crude that's being produced comes from a joint venture between a Vietnamese company and a formerly Soviet, now Russian company. And this joint venture started looking for oil, I think, quite a bit before the economic reform program got going. All the production is from a field which they call Bac Ho, where, not by accident, Mobil found oil in about 1974 during the war. Since 1987, more than a dozen production sharing agreements have been made with foreign oil companies, and a number of wells have been drilled, but none of those has produced any significant oil finds. Bac Ho is said to be now leveling off, something around 120,000 barrels a day. And so hopes are being pinned on another field, which is to the south, somewhat to the south of there, called Dai Hung, where, not by accident, Shell found oil in 1973 or 74. And another dozen or so production sharing agreements have been signed to deal with that area, a number of them, interestingly enough, with Japanese companies. We don't have a map here, but it's interesting that Bac Ho and Dai Hung are both fields that lie between the Vietnamese coast and the Spratly Islands, and some of them quite close to the Spratly Islands, so that this goes a long way to explain the tensions that exist between China and Vietnam over the Spratlys. At any rate, the two successes together, rice and oil, now give Vietnam over $1 billion a year in export earnings that they didn't have before. In fact, very nearly half of their total exports come from rice and oil. And this means that they have completely, and more than completely, replaced the aid that they were receiving from the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Soviet aid in the mid-80s was running, it's very difficult to know exactly, put a dollar figure on it, because you have not only exchange rate problems, but it was coming in different forms that are difficult to measure. It was probably $700 or $800 million a year. So rice and oil together, just those two export items, have more than compensated for the loss of Soviet aid. My third topic is the state-owned companies. I think all of the communist countries or ex-communist countries that have been trying to move toward market-oriented economic systems have run into the problem of the inefficient state-owned industrial companies that were built up under communism. Vietnam, in this sense, is relatively fortunate in that these companies form only a relatively small part of the economy. Being an agricultural economy, the state-owned industrial sector is probably only about 20% of the economy, instead of, as in some of the, I think, East European countries, maybe 50% or more. It's a real problem, therefore, but not I would say, a dominating problem. But one of the oddities about it is that nobody really seems to know how many state-owned companies there are. You can see figures like 12,000. I've seen figures of 6,000. And a World Bank report recently said 3,000. I think the explanation is that there are probably several hundred fairly large state-owned companies that are mostly owned and operated by the central government and its ministries. And then there are really thousands that are owned and operated at the level of provinces, districts, municipalities, and I suspect even villages. And the smaller ones come and go. In any case, it's very clear that many of these companies, both the large ones and the small ones, are operating at a loss. And some Vietnamese government sources are quoted as saying that the average operating rate of state-owned industrial companies has been down around 50% over an extended period. And they also have a problem that some of the state-owned companies that are profitable it's been a little difficult to get the profits from the companies into the treasury. They prefer to distribute those earnings and higher wages and perks for the workers and the managers, understandably. Until the late 1980s, the losses at the state-owned companies were made up entirely by direct budget subsidies. But since then, there's been a real major effort to cope with this problem. The direct the budget subsidies were cut off. Some of the least efficient companies were shut down, and the number of people working in these companies was reduced by about 500,000 people. But the truth is, it hasn't been possible to crack down very hard on this sector. And well, they cut off the direct subsidization, but it's very clear to me that indirect subsidies in the form of low interest rate loans from the state bank, many of them not repaid, are still continuing. I think there are several reasons why they can't really crack down on this problem, but the most obvious is that it still has 3.5 million employees. And Vietnam has a really huge unemployment problem, probably 7 to 8 million people unemployed, maybe 20% of the workforce. So cracking down on the state sector, which might throw another million people out of work if they really did it, simply politically and socially impossible. So at any rate, this is not one of the successes of the regime and must be put down as an unsolved problem. Fourth topic, foreign investment. A major feature of the economic reforms was the foreign investment law passed at the end of 1987. There have now been more than 5 years' experience with this law, and it must be rated as another success for the regime. By the end of 1992, $4.1 billion had been committed in licenses for about 470 projects. And the rate at which these projects were being licensed had been accelerating. They got $1.9 billion last year in 1992. Taiwan and Hong Kong have been the leading investors. I suppose it's not surprising, first because the U.S. was completely out of it, and the Japanese on their side were deferring to the American point of view on this until last year. The EC countries have been playing a fairly important role, but chiefly because of their contracts in the oil sector and oil production sharing agreements comprise about 1/4 of the total. Private foreign investment is particularly important for Vietnam, of course, because they're blocked in other respects, blocked by the U.S. from the World Bank funding, IMF, and Asian Development Bank, blocked also to a very large extent from commercial bank, international commercial market funding, because Vietnam has an external debt of, in hard currency, of about $3.7 billion, all of which is in default and has been in default for several years, which does not give them a very high credit rating with commercial banking community. Well, their success in this foreign investment field has been quite impressive. I think, again, I'd make a couple of reservations on it. First of all, the figures that they are putting out, like the $4.1 billion, are definitely commitment figures rather than expenditure figures. And the expenditures have been lagging badly. And expenditures, as the latest figure that I saw, total only about $1.2 billion for the whole program. Secondly, those gross figures include not only equity capital contributions, but credit, anticipated credits. And as I said, some of the credits haven't been forthcoming, and a number of the investment projects, and particularly hotel projects are ones that I think about, have been stalled because they haven't been able to get foreign bank financing. Many U.S. businessmen now seem to feel that they've been excluded from profitable opportunities in Vietnam, and I'm sure that is true. I think particularly in the oil field, they may have been excluded from some possibilities that would have been profitable for them. Nevertheless, I think there's some compensations on this. I think the early bird investors in Vietnam, many of them have encountered more problems than profits. Infrastructure gaps, ill-informed and in some cases corrupt officials, a legal system that is very inadequate, and a banking system that has been not very well developed. All of those have been problems for the early investors, and some of these problems have gradually been improved. So it's a little hard for me to believe that when the embargo is eventually lifted, the Americans will be that far behind. And I think that a number of good opportunities will still exist for them. I try to sum all of this up. I would say that during the past 4 years, Vietnam has made some really remarkable advances. 4 years ago, it was a Soviet client state. It was dependent on Soviet aid for something on the order of 6 to 8% of its GNP. It's fully recovered from the loss of that aid, and it has shifted from extensive trade with Eastern Europe to now a system of trade which is oriented toward the Pacific Rim countries, which are its natural trading partners. It even managed to have a small currency, hard currency trade surplus in 1992. It's also succeeded in attracting a certain amount, I would say a significant amount of foreign investment. These successes are partly due to what I think you would have to say has become a fairly well-designed economic reform program based on market principles. It, after a few years of really fumbling around with it, beginning around 1987, but especially since 1989, it began to understand what they were doing and got on the track. But partly the success that they've had is, you have to say, also kind of dumb luck. The fact that oil production began seriously just as Soviet aid began to decline, I think, has to be put down as fortuitous timing. And Vietnam remains a country with very big problems. Standard of living, per capita income, still around $200. And since that's higher in the south than the north, you can imagine that it's very low indeed in the north. Large unemployment, and the unemployment problem is not improving. Population growth is adding 1 million people a year to the workforce. And I don't believe that anything that's going on in Vietnam is absorbing 1 million people a year into productive jobs. Still burdened with some inefficient state-owned companies, solution not found. Many gaps in the infrastructure and in the institutions needed to support a market economy. All those things are true. Still, I would conclude by saying that Vietnam is not Cuba, and it's not North Korea. Vietnam is maybe a Soviet orphan, but it's an orphan that seems to be finding a new family in the Pacific Rim. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. We now turn to Laos.
To Cambodia.
Cambodia. Yeah, I guess that is why we lost the Vietnam War. Yes, I'm fresh in from the boondocks with lots of information, if not hepatitis and malaria germs. It's Fred Brown.
Fred? We ought to put Laos next because it's always last on any program, which I don't think is quite fair. But in any event, I'll stick to the schedule. About 4 or 5 months ago, the institute with which I'm affiliated put out a small book called Rebuilding Cambodia. It was a series of essays. Human resources, human rights, and law. I'm not trying to plug the book. About several weeks ago, one of the authors of that book, Bob Muscat, who many of you may know, received a letter from a French scholar written in the most erudite, slashing French imaginable, in which he said in one line, "I have read your book. I find it has as much relevance to Cambodia as to the planet Mars. Yours truly, sincerely." That may be true. I've just come back from a couple of weeks in Cambodia, and I have some impressions that I'll impart to you. But I am reminded after this latest trip to Cambodia of what many of us used to feel during the Vietnam War, that we were preparing our team for an Olympic-level swimming meet with a beautiful swimming pool and clean water and all the accoutrements that you can imagine for Olympic competition. But unfortunately, the other team was playing soccer, and they were in another amphitheater a mile away, and that had really very little relevance to what was of central gut importance to the war we were involved in. Coming back from Cambodia, I feel that we are doing, in many respects, a superb swimming pool arrangement for the elections, which will be coming up here in a little more than 6 weeks. But there is not only a soccer game going on, there is a polo match and a few other things going on in the countryside and in the Khmer social and political environment that we simply do not understand and are not tuned into, and the international community is not equipped to handle. That is a subjective appraisal on my part, but I think it gives you a sense of the extraordinary fluidity and difficulty and complexity of the current situation in Cambodia. I think most of you in this room are familiar with the background to the October 1991 Paris agreements. I'm not going to go into that very complex document and all its provisions. Let me start by offering the observation that whether we like it or not, the objectives of the Paris agreements, which were signed by the Perm 5 and the Security Council, by 15 other countries that have become sort of the core group for Cambodia and who were very important in actually carrying out the UN's mandate in Cambodia, also signed by the four Cambodian parties, the Khmer Rouge, which is called in Cambodia now PDK. You don't use the term Khmer Rouge so much. You use PDK, Party of Democratic Kampuchea. That's a nicety that's been introduced into the current struggle. The State of Cambodia government, the SOC, S-O-C, formerly the People's Republic of Kampuchea. And then at that time, in October of 91, the two so-called non-communist factions, Phun Sen Pek, Sihanouk's party, now Ranarit's party, and the KPNLF, then Song San's party, now who knows whose party, split into at least two factions and relatively marginalized. The Paris agreements were signed, and in due course, UNTAC, after a transitional UNAMIC, the acronym for the sort of forward party for the UN, UNTAC has been in Cambodia now since March 15, 1992, formally. When you talk to people at UNTAC, you will find them citing several successes. One is the return of refugees for the most part, from camps in Thailand, some 350,000 Cambodians, many of whom displaced since 1975. Or 1979, returned to if not their home province in Cambodia, then someplace where they can theoretically make a living. This is cited as one of the successes of the UNTAC effort there. A second success is the registration of what is judged to be 95% of the potential electorate in Cambodia, some 4.5 to 4.8 million potential voters. A third success, until recently at least, has been claimed that there has been a ceasefire in Cambodia. Actually, the ceasefire in recent weeks has, it was never perfect, but has deteriorated very, very badly. These are the main successes cited so far. The fact that there is movement toward an electoral process today in Cambodia. I think we must look at really the basic failures, unfortunately, of the Paris agreements. And rather than say failure, I'd like to choose another word, because failure implies it's cataclysmic and final. I don't think the recent course of events in Cambodia, or necessarily the next 6 months, indicate that the whole international effort in Cambodia is a failure or will be a failure. I don't want to take that position. But let us admit a couple of things. First of all, the comprehensive nature of the Paris agreements, that is to say, the inclusion of the PDK, or the Khmer Rouge, in the process of bringing peace to Cambodia has not succeeded. There has not been a neutral and political environment created. That is quite clear. Anybody you talk to in Cambodia today will not make the argument. Mr. Akashi will not make the argument. Indeed, he makes the contrary argument. There is no neutral political environment, which was the precondition in October 91 in Paris for a movement towards peace in Cambodia. Under the Paris agreements, UNTAC was directed to play an important guiding role, or at least a very heavy supervisory role, in the five key ministries of foreign affairs, defense, internal security, finance, and information. Unfortunately, the civil component of UNTAC has not been able to play this important role as planned under the Paris agreements. There are a number of reasons for this. And perhaps we can get into that in the question period. The cantonment of the factions' forces, the four factions' forces, has not taken place. This is because of the Khmer Rouge's, PDK's, refusal to put its forces into a cantonments designated by the UNTAC, and then subsequently permitting the disarmament of their forces, and then finally the demobilization of a certain percentage. This was all supposed to have been accomplished by the summer of last year. It has not been accomplished. There was a period of time when cantonment did take place. There was some disarmament and temporary demobilization. That basically has been reversed now, because the major player militarily against the PDK, of course, is the State of Cambodia government. It has not found it possible in this environment of continued antagonism, military confrontation with the Khmer Rouge, to leave a portion of its troops in a disarmed state. So basically, you have very much back to the status quo ante of the armed forces of the various parties being pretty much intact as they were in the fall of 1991. So I would submit that the basic preconditions under which the Paris agreements were undertaken have not been accomplished. And I think you would find very little argument against that in the high councils of UNTAC today, or among the diplomatic community or international community in Cambodia. Now, what are the questions that people are asking today, at least in the international community? One question is, who will win the election on May 23 through May 27? Second question is, what is the strategy, or what has been and what may be the strategy of the Khmer Rouge during this period and after the election itself? Third is, what is the strength of the State of Cambodia, what is euphemistically called the existing administrative apparatus? There are a whole lexicon of wonderful terms that have been created as a result of the Paris Agreement in Cambodia. You can almost talk in a foreign language when you deal with the Paris Agreements in Cambodia, which, a language that would be unintelligible to someone who didn't understand the theory of the Paris Agreements. Fourth, to what extent do what we used to call the non-communist Cambodian elements, that is to say, Phun Sen Pek and the KPNLF spin-off parties, to what extent do they play or can they play a significant role in Cambodia's future? Fifth, what is Sihanouk more part of the problem than of the potential solution? This is really a fundamental question that I think we should have a good give and take on during the discussion period. And sixth, what is UNTAC's current predicament? How are they going to handle the next several months? So let me take a look at, give you some ideas on these basic questions. Who will win the election? That's not the question. It's the wrong question. Don't ask that question. In one sense, it doesn't make any difference who wins the election. There are no good guys running in this election. No good guys. First of all, the Khmer Rouge are not running, needless to say. They are playing potentially a spoiler's role in this whole thing. And one of the huge question marks is what strategy they are going to follow. But in terms of the electoral process itself, we're not talking about an event which ends on May 27 or whenever the last tendered or challenged ballots are counted. And indeed, there may be as much as many as 20% of the ballots may be challenged. UNTAC is hoping that it will be as low as 5%, because every challenged ballot in Cambodia in May 23, 27 must go to Phnom Penh, and the thumbprint of the individual who cast that ballot must be checked against the central register. And UNTAC is importing a host of fingerprint experts to go to make this determination. But one thing seems quite clear to me, and that is that whatever the results are from the May 23-27 exercise, you are really at the beginning of a very, very long process. It could last up to 4 months, maybe 5 months. That will have a number of other steps. Now, the subsequent steps could founder if the election itself does not come off. That's for certain. I think the election itself will be held, and I think it may be one of the most meticulously, scientifically correct elections that Asia has seen, probably more so than many elections in the United States. UNTAC, I think one of its big successes is at least putting in place a technically very sophisticated mechanism for balloting, together with an information campaign, which is getting across one point. Your ballot is secret. No matter what the PDK tell you or what the SOC tells you, that your vote is going to be known by one party or the other, therefore you're going to be persecuted because of your vote, that if the idea can be gotten across to the majority of the Cambodian voters that their vote is indeed secret, that they will not be subject to retribution for the way they think, then that is really quite an accomplishment. And the machinery to ensure this is extraordinary. 400 tons of special election equipment being flown into Cambodia for putting into 1,400 sites. There are going to be international polling station supervisors at every site. UNTAC is training 50,000 Cambodians to supervise this process, et cetera, et cetera. So technically, it's going to be an extraordinary event. And my feeling is that technically it's going to come off, barring extraordinary disruption by the Khmer Rouge. But that is only the first step in a very, very long process, the next step being the announcement of the results. Now, this could take anywhere from a couple of days to a couple of weeks. We hope to God that it does not take 2 or 3 weeks to count all the tendered ballots. If it does, there is an extraordinary opportunity for mischief from various sources. But let us say you get through the counting and announcement of results period. Then there is the the 120 people elected to the Constituent Assembly begin their work to write the Constitution. Now, all the major parties have a constitution in draft. And the question will be, this is not going to be Philadelphia. This is going to be something very, very different. There are going to be bad guys with AK-47s and all sorts of potential mischief around the Constitution writing assembly. But popular wisdom is that if the Constitution can possibly be written and agreed upon by a two-thirds vote within 2 or 3 weeks, this is the best possible outcome. If it takes 3 months, which is the maximum allowed under the Paris agreements, then Cambodia is in deep trouble. But let us assume that there is a constitution written and that is adopted by the two-thirds of the assembly. The National Assembly, then that Constituent Assembly then becomes the National Assembly, and it forms a government. One key issue that must be addressed by the Constituent Assembly is whether or not there will be a president. Now, Sihanouk, I don't know what the reading is this morning. Somebody said that Sihanouk has made another statement, so I stand to be corrected. But it is believed that the Constituent Assembly will write into the Constitution a provision for the election of a president, which obviously is going to be Sihanouk, and that it will also determine the powers of the president. This will have an extraordinary effect on the whole process. But let us assume that that is written into the Constitution, that the Constitution is promulgated in July or August, and that then a new government is formed. Possibly a part of the process will be having an election for president, which Sihanouk will take office and exercise the powers of the president or of a prime minister, what have you. We now get to the bottom line. And this is why I say the question who will win the election is really not very important. Will the people who dominate that National Assembly and the new government which will emerge from it, will the people who, quote, win, honor the rights of the minority, of the people who did not win? The other side of the coin is, will the people who lose honor the right of the majority to form a government and press on with the very much needed economic development and political stability that Cambodia...